You're listening to Screen Heroes on the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Screen Heroes, your film podcast here on the Heroes Podcast Network. I am your regular host, Derek, and I have with me my two lovely regular co-hosts, Ryan.
Hi.
And Ray.
What's up?
What is up? We are back. This is episode 218, and we are doing a retro review of 1989's Batman from Tim Burton, starring Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. So we will be getting to that shortly. But first, the latest news. We got lots of stuff to cover. First,
We got some stuff. All right.
First, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about some controversy that's come out from the set of Justice League, the theatrical version where Joss Whedon came in and Ray Fisher had said very publicly, very, very kind of bluntly, that there was some shit going on set from Whedon, from DC Entertainment people like Geoff Johns, from Warner Brothers Pictures people. And it created a hostile work environment. People were very unhappy. Even he received what he believed to be threats about being replaced as our cyborg in the movie universe of DCEU. And there was going to be an official investigation. Warner Media decided they were going to go and dive into this with a third-party investigation, Warner Media being the umbrella that Warner Brothers Pictures is under. Mm-hmm. And then a bunch of articles hit saying that this isn't going anywhere and they've been trying to handle these claims and Ray Fisher's not cooperating, that he's refusing to meet with them and just being, you know, difficult across the board. Then Ray Fisher came out and basically said that this is not the case and that he did try to meet with an investigator who originally was supposed to be impartial from Warner Media. He believes that this investigator is actually directly from Warner Brothers Pictures and is bypassing Warner Media. And he posted that there was another person on the line with the investigator as a witness, something he was not made aware of. He wanted to end the call because he wanted then his own rep on the line to be a witness on his end of the conversation, which, I mean, at least from my perspective, seems fairly legit. And so the conversation ended, and this seems to be the support that is being used by Warner Brothers Pictures to say that he is not being cooperative. The latest development being that Jason Momoa has stepped up and said that he supports Ray Fisher in not so many words. And so he now has that on his side as well. Momoa, of course, has always been very vocal. He was vocal of the Snyder Cut being released as well. He's definitely no stranger to being upfront about how what he believes in and that sort of thing. So, Ryan, let's start with you. What do you think about this situation?
About specifically Momoa supporting or just in general?
Any aspect of it that you find
interesting. Well, I mean, I think that the whole thing is pretty crappy, you know, if it's true. What he's saying about Geoff Johns and about Joss Whedon, especially because I know you really looked up to, maybe not looked up to, or you had a lot of respect for Geoff Johns, and everything I knew about him was through you, essentially. And so, you know, this is basically completely the opposite of what I was led to believe he was. So, you know, that's disappointing. Joss Whedon, I mean, I think we've all, based on the last few things he's worked on, has kind of seen his descent into not good stuff, sexism in his movies, you know, or the way he treats the women characters and things like that has kind of dropped, you know, in the respect category. But yeah, I'm glad Momoa's supporting him. They were trying to turn social media and everybody against him and really failed because it was a horrible way of handling it, just saying that he was upset because of the way his role was written and that's why he's lashing out and ruining his career forever. That's, nobody buys that. So, and if they do, then they need to think about it a little more carefully.
Yeah, and a lot of these headlines aren't helping, saying things like it's been debunked when no real conversation has actually been had at all for the investigation. That's not what debunking means. there may not have been any progress, but that definitely doesn't determine the validity of what either side is saying. Ray, what are your thoughts?
Oh boy. So I think that it takes a lot of courage to risk your career, because we all know that there, the people he's calling out have a decent amount of power, and the people behind them, behind closed doors, have even more power. And we saw with the Weinstein situation that it was very easy for some of these actresses to be blackballed pretty fast. So recently, both him and John Boyega have come out with various issues with their roles and the people behind them. And I think whether or not they are correct, it still takes a lot of guts to go out and voice your displeasure. Like, I was mistreated, I was informed incorrectly, I was lied to, and this is how it is. So first of all, I do want to just note that I believe Ray Fisher, I believe John Boyega, so whether or not other people do is not really a concern of mine. But it's even better that Momoa is behind him. You know, the more of his castmates behind him, the better. And we know that Snyder's behind him as well. So I just think that however this goes, I love that he is sticking to everything, that he hasn't backtracked or walked back, and he's not scared for his career in any way. He's just like, this was wrong, this happened on set, and I'm gonna speak out against it.
Yeah, well said. I'm totally with you on all of that. Echo it all. Anything else anybody would like to add then before we move on to our next topic?
OEB, handle your business.
Yeah, yeah, get your shit in order.
Yeah, get all your crap together and put it somewhere and just store it there. You know, throw it away maybe, throw it in a crap container, but make sure that crap is together and taken care of.
Well, to kind of, you know, lean on what Ray was saying, you know, this whole situation, Warner Brothers certainly has more at stake if Ray Fisher is right, you know, than if they don't. You know, if Ray Fisher is not correct, he is still an up-and-coming actor. This was his supposedly his big breakthrough role because he was a stage performer prior to his role as Cyborg. Meanwhile, the people who are being named on the other end of this are Whedon, who is basically an A-list director, right?
Well, I don't think he's kind of falling off the map now.
Yeah, he hasn't directed anything since Justice League.
That's fair. But, you know, Geoff Johns was basically leading DC Comics until relatively recently, and now that seems to be Jim Lee. And there's a lot of other people on the Warner Brothers side, you know, that are involved in this. So I think part of the problem here is that Warner Brothers has a vested interest in not being at fault.
Here's the thing. I truly believe that someone up above both Johns and Fisher and all of them know that there is some fault to WB because they did replace Geoff Johns. They did it very quickly. They did it very publicly, and they replaced him with the only other guy that had a recognizable name from the comics and the TV shows and the movies. Like, he's had his hand in a little bit of everything. So otherwise, there's no reason why Johns should have been removed. If they truly believe that Johns did nothing wrong, they would have not just kept him in his position. They would have, you know, forced him out front. He would have ran DC fandom.
That's a good point.
True.
All right, so moving on, let's talk box office a little bit. So last week was the first, quote, real box office since March with the premiere of New Mutants. But this weekend brought in Tenet, which was the big Christopher Nolan film from Warner Brothers that has been kind of considered to be the first major tentpole film to relaunch movie theaters, because AMC promised to have 70% of their screens open in time for Tenet. It did bring in just over $20 million, which is a lot better than New Mutants last weekend, which was $7 million. And New Mutants brought in just over $3 million this weekend, so almost a 60% drop there. No real competition, though. New Mutants was second place. So Tenet brought in $20 million domestically, which is a pretty good number. Brings its grand total to $152 worldwide, which, you know, considering the pandemic, seems pretty good to me. Its budget is pretty big, though. So it's a $224 million budget. So this film was clearly expected to bring in the money. Both films are, you know, Tenet is performing well with everybody. It's got a 74% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 78% from audiences. So people do like it. It's definitely got a lot of positive buzz, whereas New Mutants is very rotten, down at 33%. I know a couple of people that went to go see Tenet in theaters, but you know, I did not. I might have rented it on VOD if they had done something similar to Bill and Ted. But Ryan, you didn't go see it, did you?
Nope. I'm still not feeling comfortable going into movie theaters. So.
Yeah, same here. I would ask you, Ray, but I think I would know.
If you do know. Snuck away. You know, Sturgis caused, there we go, that's a word, 260,000 more cases of COVID. Now, obviously, these people aren't, some may be life-threatening and others may be just experiencing the cold flu symptoms, but yeah, I'm gonna stay away from public places for a while.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I can't imagine going to the theater this year, but you know,
we'll see.
The only other movie that's really making any waves, either positive or negative, is the live action adaptation of Mulan from Disney, which hit Disney Plus this past weekend with the premium price tag of $29.99 for people who already have the Disney Plus service. It did premiere internationally in several markets, bringing in just under $7.5 million for the film. Can't really say how its VOD sales are doing on Disney Plus, but there is a lot of controversy around this film.
I can only go off of what I've seen on my particular feeds, in Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And so far, I've only seen one person tell or say that they paid for it on Disney Plus.
Well, I mean, there is an audience score on Rotten mm-hmm. Tomatoes. And this is where critics and audiences definitely differ, where Tenet's very even. The critics have given Mulan 76%, while audiences are only 54%. So there's definitely a gap there. And I'm wondering how much of that has to do with more of the real world behind the scenes issues.
Yeah.
That have been caused. Multiple actors, including Liu herself, who plays Mulan, have come out in support of the police forces in Hong Kong, which has been very controversial. Disney has also thanked the city of Xinjiang, where part of the film was produced. We don't know how much, and that city has been known for a lot of human rights violation issues, as well as it particularly dealing
with... I believe they're called concentration camps.
Yes, specifically dealing with Muslim people. And so it's very, very controversial, this film, across the board. Disney's being hit. Some of the actors are being hit for statements that they've made. I think that's definitely tainted people's opinions of the film and whether or not they'd even bother mm-hmm. paying to see it.
Simu Liu had a whole different point, too, that he was putting out there about it. That was more controversy.
Please.
I think that's how you say his name. Does that sound right to you guys? The guy that's playing Shang-Chi. Yeah, he said that it was that he's really he didn't call it out directly, but he basically said that he's really sick of people, of white people, focusing their stories around honor, and just assuming that that's all their culture is about, is honor and everything for honor, and that's like what white people focus on. And so it seemed like he was calling out Mulan, but also calling out Avatar The Last Airbender, because apparently, I don't know enough about Avatar, Rachel knows more, but apparently on Mulan, it was like all white executive producers and, you know, people in charge and writers. Mm-hmm. So.
Absolutely. I think Simu brings up a good point that if you're going to have diversity in front of the camera to say that things are diverse, then you need to have them behind the camera as well. And, you know, starting in the writer's room. Now, Avatar The Last Airbender was a bit more diverse behind the camera than Mulan was, but it was still majority of white men who wrote the episodes and created, directed. So,
and I think that I've watched Avatar The Last Airbender and I haven't watched Mulan. I've watched the original, but I mean, I think that I feel like they're, at least on Avatar, they were really trying to handle it in a respectful way. There was nothing in Avatar that made me feel like they were mocking the culture or doing anything offensive on purpose. Everything was like, it seemed like they're really trying to honor as best they knew. And I think part of it is just that they don't really know the culture. You know what I mean? Like I can only write about what I know. And if all I know about a culture is that, you know, they have a heavy focus on honor, then that's what I'm going to lean on when I'm writing stories about that culture. And so, yeah, I mean, everything in Avatar was handled really, really respectfully, I thought, but I could definitely understand how it would be offensive to someone who knows more about the culture and knows it's deeper than this one thing.
Well, it's a bit obvious that they stepped outside of their comfort zone, especially when it comes to the different cultures and the martial arts. They wanted things to be unique and respectful. So I haven't seen Mulan. I can't say anything towards or against it, but it's definitely an issue having a ton of white people write stuff for people of color as the characters. You know, we really shouldn't be the mouthpieces. And
even if it's respectful, understand the culture, like, you just have to, it's not that hard to find somebody who probably does understand the culture, especially when you're a huge company like Disney.
Absolutely.
Also, not less offensive about Mulan, but more just kind of stupid, they got rid of Mushu because he was too fantastical and not grounded enough, but then they have a lady that can turn into a bird.
Yeah, they have a witch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what the heck? Oh, but whatever.
Honestly, Mushu was so great. There's so much issues with the live action. I feel like they should have just adapted it the way they have the others. Full on music, full on Mushu, full on
Mushu was one of my favorite parts of the original. So it's sad to me that he's not in this version, but whatever.
So segue.
Please.
Since we were just talking about Simu Liu, production on Shang-Chi has resumed down in Australia since, you know, they've got their COVID shit together.
He's also a delight to follow on Twitter, so if you aren't following him, highly recommended. He seems like a delightful human being.
He does. He seems like a cool dude.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, if you don't want to pay the $30 price tag to pseudo purchase Mulan on Disney Plus, you can wait until December 4th and watch it as just part of Disney Plus,
which you absolutely should. Do not support streaming services overcharging us. Like, we already pay for a ton of streaming services. Don't support this.
It is weird, especially because if you go to the page, it straight up says on the app right now that it's December 4th. Mm-hmm. So they're not hiding it. It's right in your face. If you can hold out for 3 months, then it's no extra cost to you if you already have.
It's interesting that they're going to be doing that, that they're pushing that too. I would have waited until, like, I would have thought they would wait until, like, The Mandalorian is going to be streaming its last episode, and then they release it so that mm-hmm. you have another month of payment. But instead, they're doing it like in the middle of the Mandalorian's run, so that's odd.
It is strange. It's definitely strange across the board. I don't really understand their thought process on this.
We're not getting a Marvel show this year, right? Was that confirmed?
No, we are not.
Okay.
Yeah, and like that's even crazier, right? So you'd think they'd want to spread out what they do have,
yeah,
a little bit.
Because WandaVision could be completed and released, but the problem is continuity wise they have it right in between Loki and Doctor Strange, or Falcon and Doctor Strange. So it has to release at a certain time.
Yeah, that's the problem with these movies being all in the shared universe, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep. Speaking of The Mandalorian, though, we did get some new set photos, high-quality set photos of some of our characters.
Some good post photos, too. Entertainment Weekly gets some good stuff.
They do, they do. Carl Weathers looks good. Glad mm-hmm. to see that, that he's returning. I love him, and so I like seeing that he's got what appears to be a prominent role in season two. I hope is a prominent role in season two.
It was a pretty prominent role in season one.
Well, if you look at it, their IMDb is Carl Weathers and why can't I think of her name? The woman who played Gina Carano. Both of them only did 3 episodes last season, which is crazy considering how much I remember about their importance. But there's
Gina, I feel like I don't know, it didn't seem like she played as much of a role, so I can believe that she was 3 episodes. But Carl Weathers, I thought, felt like he was more than 3 episodes.
No, he's that presence. Three.
Yeah, it just goes to show like what he brings to the screen when mm-hmm. he's there. He's just he's memorable.
He's directing an episode this season too, because that was part of his deal. So mm-hmm. When he did season one, they said if they get renewed for season two, then he wants to direct an episode. So I am curious to see how that goes. Yeah.
I didn't know he directed. I wonder what else he's done. That's really interesting.
I don't know, but yeah, maybe this is his first thing.
Maybe. I did like I saw some headlines that are like, well, Baby Yoda's still a baby. Like, well, yeah.
I think he just aged up like 50 years and like how little time is between season one and season two.
You know, he's not a human child like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air or something where you just age Nikki up so he can have lines. It's
also, he isn't still a baby. He's 50 years old. Maybe 51 at this point. I don't know. It's hard to say.
Its name is not Baby Yoda. We're just calling it that because we don't know.
No, but it is called the child, right?
So, yeah, it is the child. Baby. But, like, I think that's also, you know, people not understanding how that species exists either.
Right.
You know.
When you live for 900 years, it's, you know, you have a long childhood.
I guess. Is that how it works with elves, too? Are elves considered children at 50?
They pretty much mature. They mature at human speeds.
Do they? Okay.
Yeah.
They're just perpetually youthful.
Yeah, exactly. Once they hit like 18, they stay 18 looking until they're like 100.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Well, fair enough. The things you learn.
Right.
Any other news pieces that you would like to talk about tonight?
Yes.
Just one.
Ooh.
Oh, what? Rachel has one too? Hit me, Rachel.
Okay. So, one of my favorite TV shows of all time, one of my favorite cartoons, was recently canceled. Wow. And I want to discuss this. Venture Brothers was officially canceled by Cartoon Network and Adult Swim. And Jackson Publick, Doc Hammer, both of them released statements about it, confirming those were the creators. And I have to say that the show has been on for 17 years. And yet, they have 7 seasons. So, I have to say, and I may get some hate from other Venture Brothers. Don't get me, or other Venture Brothers fans, but don't get me wrong. I love this show. I think it's one of the best shows out there. But when you have 7 seasons in 17 years, it is not just the studios or production companies' fault. Like, creators, writers, they're behind that too. Something is wrong. Voice cast or animators, something. So I'm really happy that HBO Max is looking to pick it up. That would be great if they got a wrap up, because season 7 left a lot of open threads. But for real, like, the fans need to calm it down. it's not the most tragic thing ever.
I'm not a big Venture Brothers fan, so I don't really have an opinion on the matter.
Fair enough.
Well, I mean, I'm sad for the fans out there, but other than that.
it's disappointing when a show gets stuck in that situation. It would be nice if they were given an opportunity to wrap things up. Like we were talking about with Doom Patrol, right? If Doom Patrol doesn't get a season three, I think as fans, we deserve some kind of finale to wrap up what we've invested two seasons into and paid for, you know, to see these stories. And I imagine those Venture Brothers fans who have stuck around for 17 years, which I'm sure some of them have been there the whole time, to have it end like that is frustrating. I can understand that for sure.
So that's it. That's all I wanted to say.
All right, Ryan, what you got?
Okay. I just want to say that Derek and I are matching tonight.
We are.
In our Snyder Cut shirts. Very nice. Actually, the quality's pretty good, too. Sometimes the charity shirts like these are not super great quality. So
this hoodie is super comfortable.
Yeah, the fabric on the shirt is nice. And one thing I love about these shirts is they're very long. I have a long torso. So if it's short and, you know, some large, they're like up to my belly button, and some they're down to my knees. And so this was a nice, good, nice length. So, but yeah, all the proceeds for this went to Zack Snyder's charity of choice, I believe. I don't remember the name of it.
I believe it's the American Society for Suicide Awareness.
Is that what it was?
Yes.
Yeah. And now we're associate producers.
We are. Yeah. The back say associate producer. So I got to update my IMDb.
That's right.
I get a second credit.
That's right. Yeah. I got to update my LinkedIn.
Yeah. Yeah. Support the Snyder Cut.
That's right. Even if it sucks, at least I got a cool shirt and supported something good.
That's right. Absolutely.
So, anyway, that was all my news.
All right. Well, I want to wish, because we're recording this on Tuesday night, September 8th, I want to wish everybody a happy Star Trek Day. Happy 54th birthday.
This is not Richardson Runabout.
I don't care. It's Star Trek Day. And if you go to StarTrek.com/day, you can see a whole bunch of cool stuff that they've been putting together for today. All of the panels from today are on CBS All Access's YouTube channel, which includes panels from all of the currently existing Star Trek TV series, as well as the upcoming Strange New Worlds. So lots of cool content to watch totally for free out on their YouTube channel. We're going to go ahead and take a short break. When we come back, we will be discussing Batman 89. We'll be right back. All right, and we are back to discuss Batman 1989 from Tim Burton, starring Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. This was the first live-action feature film for Batman since 1966, and a pretty substantial reimagination of the character from the Adam West version that we had in the 60s. Lots to say about it. Made a lot of money. Made over $411 million in the box office on a $35 million budget. So
in 1989.
In 1989, which is huge. I mean, first off, that was a pretty good size budget for 1989 anyway. That was a substantial budget, and it made a ton of money in 1989. Obviously, as they keep making more and more Batman movies, they continue to make more and more money as ticket prices increase. So it's a little difficult to do a direct comparison, but it's still a lot of money.
It'd be easier to compare it to other movies in 1989 that came out that were hits. But
I mean, that's fair. That's fair. So, all right, let's talk the film.
Okay, can we just for the first thing, can we say when the last time we watched this movie was?
Prior to like this weekend?
Yes, because for me, I don't know when the last time I watched this movie. It's probably been 5, maybe 10 years since I've watched it. So a lot of it was really, I felt like it was a completely fresh eye on the movie and I really enjoyed that. So,
you know, thinking through it, probably at least 5 years. I'm trying to remember when I got this Blu-ray. Because I know I watched it on this Blu-ray, but I can't quite remember when that came out. So I'm not sure, but it's definitely been several years, and it's not a movie that I've seen as much as, say, the first two Nolan films. I've seen those more often.
Or the Schumacher films, right?
Or the Schumacher films. I saw those more often. Because, like, as a kid, those two were on TV all the time. And I got to watch those all the time. Whereas Batman Returns, I saw them as a kid, but since I didn't own them until I was an adult, I didn't really get to see them much.
What about Rachel? Rachel made a face when I asked this question.
I did,
so,
yeah.
You know.
It's probably been about 20 years, and as I commented on our thread in the Screen Heroes group, I probably have never seen the movie in its entirety. I think I had seen it on TV only, and of course, if you were a child of the 90s like I was, then you saw a lot of TBS and TNT movies and realized that they cut out a lot.
They did.
Yeah, that's fair. So, okay, so we all had pretty fresh eyes for this one, which is a little surprising because, you know, we talk a lot about superheroes. We talk a lot about Batman. So I think in the back of my mind, we had all just kind of watched this movie more regularly.
Yeah, so that makes sense.
There's some obvious things to touch on. There's the visual style, because this is a Tim Burton film. This really changed what Batman looked like moving forward for... arguably, until even now, he's still being influenced by Tim Burton's styles. What do you guys think? So I just, because not a lot of movies have a cool kind of title sequence opening, so I don't get to talk about them much, but I actually really like this one, where the camera is kind of outlining this bat symbol as it pulls out. And of course, it pulls out perfectly on directed by Tim Burton, and it's all, you know, framed up really nicely. But I like that opening. Does that do anything for you guys?
It's fine. It was a little long.
It is long.
Like, one thing I did notice, well, my girlfriend actually noticed when we were watching it. This was a long time for her. She hadn't seen it in a long time either. But Jack Nicholson got top billing. He was the first name pop up over Michael Keaton. I noticed that too. So I thought that was interesting. A little insight into 1989 there.
Yeah, I mean, Nicholson clearly had, like, the more powerhouse career at that point, you know, because we talk about casting controversies all the time, but this was a huge casting controversy for Batman. Michael Keaton was...
They all are casting controversies when it comes to that character.
But, I mean, ahead of time, I don't know, I don't know that any of them were as controversial beforehand like Michael Keaton was.
So they got a letter writing campaign because he had only done like two movies at that time. It was Beetlejuice and I want to say Mr. Mom. And people thought he was just going to be a complete joke and that it wouldn't even be a joke like the Adam West one was joke. Like everybody else would try to be serious and gritty and he'd be the only one not taking it seriously. So Warner Brothers was flooded with handwritten letters. Children, this is how old this movie is. Handwritten. Your Grammys and Pop Pops decided to bitch via USPS.
That's right. Back in the time when there was a USPS.
So too soon, man. Too soon.
I'm gonna cry.
Yeah, and there's some very interesting kind of behind the scenes stuff about the movie too, because Jack Nicholson's contract was really unique. He took a percentage of the gross of the film, which at the time people thought was stupid, but allowed him to have the record for single movie earnings by an actor into this century. I don't know if that record's been broken yet by, say, Robert Downey Jr. In any of the Avengers films or anything like that.
Or, you know, Johnny Depp from the Pirates films.
But he did at least, before the MCU existed, he had that record for sure.
So Jack Nicholson, like, he passed on the film eventually. He was Tim Burton's first choice for Joker. He passed because he didn't really know who Tim Burton was. He didn't really know who Michael Keaton was and he didn't care for it. Well, Robin Williams was approached to play the Joker, but once the hype started getting around the Hollywood, Jack Nicholson like walked in there, swung his big old dick, and he got Joker and he got this amazing contract and he pretty much got to run his own show. Like Jack Nicholson did what Jack Nicholson wanted to because he was the most seasoned person on set, apparently in front of and behind the camera.
Yeah.
What do you think of Jack Nicholson's Joker all of these years? Because for a long time, especially before The Dark Knight, he was the Joker for most people. And now maybe it's a little more up in the air, but what did you guys think? How does his performance hold up now, you know, since so much later? 31 years.
I am so used to the Joker being this no rules psychopath that it really took me back that he was channeling part of Cesar Romero's performance, where he made the puns and he made the jokes and, you know, everything had a laugh to it. That's not how the Joker's been for quite a long time. And it just completely threw me off, I think, but in a good way. Like I forgot how fun the Joker could be now, like between Ledger and Phoenix and Leto, like the Joker's not fun. He's just frightening. And Nicholson was a little bit of fun.
Yeah, I mean, this definitely stood out. I mean, rewatching it now, it reinforced that Jack Nicholson is my favorite Joker, because it's more relevant now than it was even when, you know, years ago when there weren't as many to compare it to. But, you know, now, like Rachel said, every Joker is like this emotional mess, and they're, you know, real world mental health issues and things like that. You know, even Ledger's Joker, where he didn't get any background, there was background on him, and he was like a veteran with PTSD and whatever else. So that's at least what they came up with on set for him as a background. And that stuff is just too real for me. Like, anytime, the whole point of these movies is that it takes me away from the real world. But then when you tell me that the Joker has mental issues from PTSD or from the stuff from Joaquin Phoenix's Joker's movie, you know, where it's all legitimate things that could happen to somebody in the real world and have happened to people, you know, that takes away from the character for me. The whole point of the Joker is that nobody knows why he's crazy. You know, he's just his whole personality is this outrageous thing, and it's not based in realism. And this was kind of that for me, even though you did see him get thrown in the acid and it kind of made him a little weird and crazy, but it wasn't, you know, there's not people in the real world that have been thrown into acid and their skin turns white and they start making a lot of jokes.
So I like that, because starting from the very beginning, Jack Napier is a cruel man. He is a conniving man. He's already a bad guy. He's a gangster with goals. He wants to be at the top of the food chain. So he's already a bad guy. We didn't need any backstory on him. And personally, as someone who is not neurotypical, I have depression and anxiety, and I've been through some shit. I am tired of seeing mental illness being the sole cause for, you know, murderers and terrorists, and because that's not always it. Most of the time we're just quiet and sad. So I think just having somebody who is cruel for the sake of being cruel as the Joker, it was better for me.
Yeah, I had always said that Heath Ledger's Joker was my favorite, and after watching this, it's a much harder decision to make, because I think I had forgotten how good Jack Nicholson is in this. He's fantastic. I'm not going to go so far as to say it's his best job ever, but it's very, very good. And there are so many pieces to it that I really enjoy. I like that he puts on makeup to make his skin look normal when he goes on TV or has meetings. I like that he has some gadgets to him, right? Like the hand electrocution thing. It takes me back to the comics.
The acid squirting flower.
Yes, exactly. It's very comic booky. It's very much like, you know, the cartoons and things like that, where Batman has his gadgets, but you know what? Joker's got some too. His are just maybe a little more twisted. And
which is how it should be.
Exactly. Because at the end of the day, what's the whole point of the movie? The whole point of the movie is that they created each other.
He created this fucking boxing glove thing to punch a TV that's like 20 feet away. That was its only purpose.
I love it. It's so great.
He went through so many TVs.
Right?
And that is so good. I love it. The scene where he's cutting out pictures, right? And there's pictures that are all over the floor. They're all over the desk. It's just it's all shot really well, and he just sells every moment that he's on screen.
I turned to Derek and I was like, who knew arts and crafts was such a big deal with villains? Because it's been a while since I've seen, you know, crazy person cuts out magazines.
That's right. And the Joker does it better than anybody else.
Oh yeah, he does. And when they pan out, I promise you that's where Leto got the idea to have the knives all around him.
Probably.
Like, or at
least this one actually made some semblance of sense.
It was so much better. The knives were just so meticulous, and I'm like, I cannot imagine sitting there putting all these random knives around me and then posing for a photograph
and then tiptoeing into the middle of it so you didn't disturb any of them,
right?
And laying down just right.
And I blame this is gonna sound so mean, but I blame Leto, because David Ayer is not that creative.
Well, I don't know about that, but okay. Seems like a random shot on David. Yeah.
He's a boring director.
Like, one thing that really sells this Joker for me, though, is the way he is portrayed mentally. He's still told to be a very intelligent person, but he also has the mob background. So organized crime is already in his DNA. He's been doing it for years. He's like the number two in this organization, right? And so him taking that over is an easy sell, because he was kind of next in line anyway, and he already knows how to do all of this. So when he is running these organizations and he's threatening these other mob bosses, it's all very believable, because he's already living in that world. Whereas, you know, Heath Ledger's Joker, he is a complete foreign body that's introduced to Gotham out of nowhere. And I still love that performance. I still think it's wonderful and just really incredible work. But I don't know. I think maybe the Nicholson one might take the cake.
It's a certainty for me that it takes the cake. I just, like I said, even the Ledger one is just too close to reality for me. You know, that's the one thing that stood out to me about this movie as a whole, is that it really embraced the comic book. You know, like, you think of the Schumacher movies being corny and like over the top, and they were, but not in like a comic booky sense. Right. They were more over the top in like a kid's movie sense, whereas this, everything, every movement, every character made was theatrical. Batman, I mean, anytime he walked anywhere was done with a sense of purpose, and the way he walked into a room, he'd have his cape out, you know. I don't know if I'm describing it appropriately, but everything that was done by any character in this movie was done in a way that made me feel like it was closer to a comic book than any of the other Batman movies that have come out since.
I think a lot of
classic comic book, I should say, because like you look at Ben Affleck's Batman, and he's comic book accurate too, but to a totally different Batman. And this one, I think, was more accurate to a Batman that ran for a longer period of time. Probably the Batman that more people are familiar with in our age group. So,
and I think a lot of that also lends to how the movie is shot. There are just some really great still shots that look like they could just be comic book frames.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. They could be cells in a comic, whether it's him holding up his cape, right, or the Batmobile coming down the street, you know, or the Joker with his boxing glove gun. There are just some great front-on shots that look like they could have been drawn.
A lot of the shots from the Joker in the parade too.
Oh yeah.
In the Batwing, or whatever they were calling it at the time.
I don't know if they actually called it the Batwing or not.
But can we talk about how surprising that is, considering Tim Burton was a fan of the character but had never really read the comic books? He was not a fan of comic books at all. And I think it really helped having Bob Kane on set as a consultant and helping write the script. But still, I can't believe that it turned out so well. There's no reason why it should.
It is hard to believe, but I think that a lot of the way that Tim Burton works anyway is kind of parallel to the two comic book. You know, if you look at Edward Scissorhands, for example, it's all over the top too. And like, from everything from the colors to the way people move and act, that could be a comic book in itself. So I think that a lot of it was just WB, I assume whoever was in charge at the time, recognizing that Tim Burton style really suited this style, and that they were going to be able to get a good comic book character movie.
Absolutely.
Done with his style. That's the only thing I can think of, because yeah, you're absolutely right. He was not a fan of comic books, and he had never read a Batman comic, supposedly, at least before he made this movie. He probably started when he got hired, but
right.
Mm-hmm. Now there's always been one aspect to the way Joker's story is portrayed here that I used to not like, but now seeing the movie's story come full circle with kind of, you know, a more adult head on my shoulders, is that he killed Bruce's parents, right? He's Joe Chill, so to speak. And I never really cared for that because I thought it was an unnecessary connection. But thinking back on it now, I kind of like the idea that the Joker created Batman and Batman created the Joker, and they're intertwined with each other.
Yin and yang.
Right? They're two sides of the same coin kind of concept, goes back to the gadgets, that kind of thing. What do you guys think of that aspect to the story? Do you think that's a good change? Because that wasn't part of Joker's origin. Joker didn't really have an origin prior to this movie.
I like origins, to be completely honest. And I don't care if people change it up or not. But, you know, I don't think that a character having a mystery origin works forever. You know, eventually we get bored of who is the Wolverine, who is the Joker, who is Rogue, you know, just you don't have to immediately give up the origin. You don't have to completely have it down when you first create the character, but eventually it's got to happen. So I liked it.
Yeah, it didn't really bother me then. It doesn't really bother me now. All of these things, all these different movies that have come out about Batman are all just different takes of... I mean, if you look at the comic books, there's so many different Batman stories. I mean, mm-hmm. Right now you got the Batman Who Laughs. It's a weird-ass Joker-Batman hybrid for the edgiest Hot Topic teens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many different takes on Batman that it doesn't bother me to see something different like this. You know, it was fine. And yeah, seeing it as an adult, it worked in the context of the movie. And yeah, that's an interesting idea that they created each other. So I like that. And it's you know, very Tim Burton-y. So it all comes back to, again, they had the right people there to work on this movie. I think that was really, really evident.
So let's talk Batman. Let's talk Bruce Wayne and Michael Keaton and the suit and the Batmobile, all that kind of good stuff. Real quick, I forgot how thick the rubber is on that cowl.
Yep.
Rewatching it. It is.
That poor man.
You know,
it's like 3 inches thick right around his nose. I'm like, Jesus, dude.
You know, he couldn't turn his neck, right? That's kind of where the Batman turn came from. And he reportedly couldn't even hear on set. It was so muffled that he couldn't even really make out what people were saying.
Well, I mean, the picture that you're using just for this episode, he looks strained. You know, he doesn't look like looking at Jack Nicholson is easy.
Mm-hmm. But visually, it's a good look. So, you know, I think it was maybe worth the effort and all of that hard work from him.
Do either of you know how many stunt doubles he had? Because it was obvious in some photos or in some parts of the movie that he wasn't the one in the suit all the time, but I couldn't tell when. So I was just curious. Like,
I have no idea.
No. And the size seemed to change too. There was a couple shots where the guy was really lean and lanky, and then other times when he was a bigger, thicker guy. So I was just curious.
Maybe speaking of the suit, as somebody who now in my adult years makes Batman stuff, and you know, has had a lot more eyes on it, it's interesting to me how raw and like unfinished the suit looks in a lot of the scenes. When you look at the back of the cowl, you can see like bumps from the clay when they molded it and things like that. There's a big seam that you can see in one spot. And I mean, I think that's great. Mm-hmm. It's a tale of the times, right? There had been no Batman and nobody was really doing anything like this. And so it's really cool to see that. And it's cool to see that the creators that are making them now are making them better than it actually was in 1989. But yeah, the suit was great. I mean, it's still one of my favorite suits. This one in the Batman Returns suit, which actually, it's funny when you see Batman Returns after seeing this movie and noticing how like almost raw the suit looks in this movie. It's much more finished in the next movie, where I'm guessing they gave him a higher budget and they had more experience. But yeah, the cowl is very thick and beefy looking, which is great. It's a great compliment because Michael Keaton is not thick and beefy looking in general. So, you know, you kind of got way more intimidating presence. Whereas like Ben Affleck was thick and beefy, and then on top of that wore a muscle suit, and like his cowl had no neck. So, you know, somebody like Michael Keaton needed to lean into the performance a little bit more, I feel like, to be intimidating than somebody like Affleck did. But yeah, I mean, this suit is still top notch in my book. I love it so much.
Just the first scene with him where he grabs the mugger and he's like, I'm Batman. Like, oh, God.
Right away. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Was it interesting to you guys that this, he's a year one Batman. He's like only been Batman for like 2 months or something.
Yeah. It hasn't been long now.
Yeah. They imply that they've just started a file on him for the GCPD.
Because people don't think he's real yet.
Yeah. And so it's still a myth. Super interesting to me because I had completely forgotten how early he was in his career here. But yet he has this completely armored suit. He has the Batwing. He has this crazy Batmobile. So, I mean, it's pretty nuts to me that this is a year one, like month three Batman.
Mm-hmm. And I love that we didn't get the origin story right at the beginning. I love that it came a little bit later.
It seemed like it was, though. Like, if you didn't know going into it, which I had forgotten where it played in the movie, I was like, oh, great, they're going to show this again. Because it's a couple with their kid, and they're just like running through a street, and they like head down an alley. The only thing that makes it any different is that the names, when they say people's names. But if you didn't know the character's names or anything, you would think this is just Batman's origin shown again.
So one cool fact you're talking about, you know, when he says, I'm Batman, that line was ad-libbed by Michael Keaton. The actual script was supposed to say, I am Vengeance.
Which they did in the Pattinson movie now.
Which they're doing now,
so cool.
Exactly. So, like,
what
first
a great
off,
callback.
Right? So, it's a wonderful callback. It clearly is a great callback. And at the same time, it shows that Michael Keaton gave us what's kind of one of the most iconic lines that Batman now has, at least in live action. And so it's a really cool moment that's now coming full circle.
Yeah.
So what did you guys think of Michael Keaton as Bruce Wayne?
I think he's a great Bruce Wayne. I think he plays him a little off, a little, you know, kind of off balance or on edge. And I think that that works. I think that it's more realistic for what would be going on in that person's head.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Unless he was truly a psychopath, which I don't really want my Batman to truly be a psychopath because he's supposed to be fighting for justice. Right.
Batman's supposed to be a sociopath, not a psychopath. That's Superman. Right.
Exactly. Exactly to the first half of that sentence, and then you said Superman, and that's not, I don't know. But anyway, I like the way Michael Keaton plays the character on kind of this razor thin edge. You know, no fault of his own. I think it's silly that Vicky finds out his secret identity already, but that's a separate issue.
Yes, I have plenty to say about Vicky. But I liked him as Bruce Wayne. I liked that he was unassuming, that people at his party had no idea who he was. And
that was interesting to me. That point itself, that nobody knew who Bruce Wayne was. That hasn't happened in any movie, any Batman movie since then, I don't think.
It implies that he is gone since his parents passed away. Under the radar, that he didn't pop up at charity balls. He wasn't running Wayne Enterprises just yet. Like,
but it's not limited to that because when they show the flashback to the night his parents were murdered, nobody on the street knows that this is Thomas Wayne and Martha Wayne. They get passed over for a cab. Like, they're just fighting for a cab like everyone else. So, I mean, it's their whole family is almost unknown, it seems like, to Gotham, despite being billionaires and having this huge mansion. Like, when he asks if she had trouble finding the place, I laughed at that, but then, like, that's supposed to be a serious moment because he doesn't laugh at it like he's making a joke. He legitimately is asking her if she had trouble finding the place. So it makes me wonder if, like, in this Gotham, there's a lot of billionaires and a lot of mansions.
Well, that line didn't work for me because wasn't she there like the night before? for the party.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Good so point. Like,
that was a weird line, but I get your point. I totally appreciate your point. I think that line just doesn't make any sense.
I thought I would have made more sense if he laughed afterwards, but because he didn't laugh, it made it weird.
Right. Yeah. There you go. Yeah,
like exactly. It would have been a great joke, but then he was serious about it. But I did like how he was like, I don't even know if I've ever been in this room. You know, it's, you know what he did play as Bruce Wayne. I still think he's probably the best Bruce Wayne we've gotten, if not top two for sure. For me anyway, he like you guys said, on the razor's edge. When you see him having to be creative when the Joker shows up at Vicky Vale's place, when he puts the thing under his suit and then like starts acting crazy to get shot by the Joker. You know, I thought that was an interesting thing. I mean, we haven't seen something like that since then.
Mm-hmm.
I was a big fan of his Bruce Wayne, seeing it again. Mm-hmm.
I think he plays both really well. And I think that that's a problem that most of the live action actors have, is that they do one of them well, but you have to be able to handle both characters. Right. Because they really are two different characters,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's not easy. I understand that it's definitely not an easy task, but I think he pulls it off.
Yeah. And then you want to get nuts. Let's get nuts. Line was I wish that was ad-libbed by him, because that would be great. But it's yeah, great, you, yeah. You started to see a little Beetlejuice peek through in that line.
Yes.
A little bit.
Which is fine. I mean, it's the same actor, so you can only do so much. But yeah, I liked it. It definitely shows the more unhinged side of Bruce Wayne.
Right. And that's what Beetlejuice basically is. Beetlejuice is a totally unhinged character. So like that's fine. That didn't really bother me, but I did think it was funny. Mm-hmm. So do we want to talk Vicky Vale then?
Okay.
I don't really have much to say about her. She's
awful.
One dimensional.
Vicky Vale is absolutely awful. You meet this guy. The next day you have a date with him. You sleep over. You have a wonderful time. You are already making plans for the same day, and you're bummed when he can't make it. Like, that is very clingy. Next, you catch him in a lie. His butler betrays him, and that's a different story, bro. Like, get your wingman shit together. But instead of just, like, either choosing two sane paths, asking him why he lied, and moving on from there, or, you know, letting it go and not seeing the guy because you don't like a liar, you stalk him. What?
Big time.
What? No, she is not a good character. She is not a good person. She is not a good journalist. Like, stop. Full stop. Worst love interest ever. Can we go back to Forever, where we get the super horned up Nicole Kidman instead, because at least she was, it to me, sane.
Was she a journalist? I thought she was just a photographer.
She's a photojournalist.
Fair
enough.
When she's following him and he takes the flowers to, you know, the alley where his parents were killed, and he puts the flowers on the ground and leaves, what, she doesn't think for a moment, oh well, obviously something bad happened here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go ahead and pick up these flowers that are clearly a tribute, you know, in memory of something not happy. I'm going to pick them up.
That was super insensitive.
Right?
Absolutely.
You know, and then she digs all into it about what happened and finding out that his parents were murdered. And then, like, then Alfred just lets her into the Batcave.
Classic Alfred.
What is that about?
I absolutely adore that Bruce Wayne line where he's like, why don't you marry her? Yeah,
he probably would if he could, man. He's not a billionaire, you know, playboy.
Well, I think they would have made a cute couple.
Agreed. At least Alfred's great, Alfred.
And at least he's consistent in the four films, right? Like, you know, getting Batgirl involved in Batman and Robin. He's already got a suit made for her like 20 minutes after she shows up.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly he's at least consistent through the four films. But...
Is he the only character that's consistent through the four?
No, Commissioner Gordon.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Gordon is the same in all four?
Yes.
I'm
missing? Pat Hingle.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know who is great and a little under, like, underappreciated, I feel like, in this movie was the guy that played that dirty cop in like the first half of the movie episode, like the chemicals thing. Eckhart. That dude was great. He was cheesing it up. He was over the top in the best way. And, you know, watching this movie back now, it was, I very much appreciate what he did for the movie.
Yes. Hands down. I think he does a much better job than the same character in the Nolan films.
Yes. Agreed.
Personally. So one other character, at least that I think is worth mentioning, of course, is Harvey Dent.
Is he worth mentioning? He's in like 10 seconds of the movie.
Well,
no, he had like 4 or 5 scenes. He got a ton of lines. He got a few monologues.
He's also played by Billy Dee.
I thought he had I was remembering him having a much smaller role than what he actually did.
I think the worst thing about the character for me is that he doesn't go anywhere. Right, yeah. Because Schumacher didn't bring him back. And so that arc that they start building in this film that I think has a lot of promise, and I think that Billy Dee's got this amazing charisma about him to play this kind of character that, given what it was supposed to become, would have been, I think, super interesting. Mm-hmm. It's almost a bummer.
Oh, it's completely a bummer. The fact that he starts off as this great guy, smaller role, he comes back for the sequel, a little bit larger of a role, still a great guy. And in the third movie, he could have easily like started this downfall. And then the fourth movie, he's the big bad. Like, that is some well done storytelling. But that's not what happened.
It's not. And it's sad. And, you know, we've talked about Batman Forever when we've talked about Tommy Lee Jones's Harvey Dent. And, you know, as a little kid, I enjoyed that character a lot. But I think Billy Dee Williams would have been better for the role as it was already, like, as it was being designed initially. So, but what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Any other topics, though, that you want to cover as we are now over our 1 hour mark on this week's episode?
I want to bring up a point that has bothered me since I was a kid watching this movie.
Please.
So I want to preface this with, I love Joker's super long revolver. What a cool Jokery weapon to have. You know, it's just such a silly thing. But how does he shoot down the Batwing with a single bullet from that revolver?
Nope.
I get that it's like supposed to be super accurate because of its long barrel, but like, did he hit a fuel line or something? is he that good of a shot? Is he Deadshot?
I mean, that's an argument for this being year one Batman, you know, and it's his first go at
making a plane. He has a really poorly designed Batwing that can only take one revolver shot. Also, this Batman doesn't give a fuck. He is shooting bullets at all kinds of people. He shot 2 missiles at the Joker. He's like, he threw a dude off the like top of this building. He threw Joker. I mean, everybody's dying all around him. He straight up is just murdering people and doesn't care.
This Batman easily kills 2 dozen or more people.
Easily. Yep. It's not even
intentionally.
You know, when we talk about, it's not even when we talk about like he caused a car accident that killed somebody. No, he's like throwing people off of buildings,
blowing up buildings.
Right at the beginning of the movie, when those guys, when he first shows up on those muggers, and they're like, I heard he threw a guy off a 5-story building and there was no blood left in the body. And the guy's like, yeah, it's because it all came out because he just fell 5 stories. I was like, oh my God, this Batman does not give a shit.
Yeah, he is killing people.
It is great. I love it so much.
Can I just say that I absolutely adore the fact that this Batman isn't a world-class martial artist ninja. Like,
he actually gets his ass kicked.
He gets his ass kicked all the time. Oh my God, he goes from being amazing to bad, and I love it because that is the Batman that I adore. I truly love.
Batman shouldn't be perfect,
right? I love a fallible Batman.
Agreed. And that made it more believable that he's in his first few weeks as Batman, right? You know,
maybe
this armor that he made was what he thought he needed, but then he realized he couldn't move as well in it. You know, of course, that doesn't explain why he has very similar armor in the next movie, but, you know.
But he is a better Batman. He's a better fighter. He's a better detective in the next one. So he does grow.
And Michael Keaton grew a lot as an actor too, and you can definitely tell that in the second movie.
An interesting thing from chat here is that apparently Keaton injured his hip during the first kick in the film, and that injury still kind of plagues him to this day.
Maybe he'll have a hip brace in the new movie, in the Flash movie, as a homage.
Maybe he'll wear the mechanical suit from Kingdom Come.
Or use the cane.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. Well, there are some cool facts that I think are worth mentioning. This is the only live-action Batman film that features a single supervillain from the comics.
Cool.
Every other film has more than one, which is interesting to think about. Let's see. What else? This is the highest grossing film of 1989 domestically and was only beat internationally by Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. So there you go. Highest grossing domestic film of 1989, which I think is saying something. I think that's a big deal. Anything else that you would like to cover on Batman 89 this week?
I have one more thing. Why in the final scene, when Joker and Vicky Vale are going up all those stairs, does Batman decide, even with his like weird leg injury that he got from crashing the Batwing, that he also needs to go up all those stairs when he clearly has a grapple gun that works just fine because he uses it shortly after? It was the most asinine thing ever. Mm-hmm. He's like limping up all these stairs, but he has a grapple gun.
Oh, yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah, no, I thought that too. I'm completely with you there.
Maybe he had a head injury when he landed the Batwing. And
that must be it. Yeah.
Yeah, his detective brain wasn't working very well.
Guy had a concussion. Yep.
This did start the trend of non-detective Batmans, though.
Yes.
That has still gone on to this day.
It has been an issue. But it looks like our next film with Pattinson is going to change
it's
that.
True.
So
it's true.
That is a good thing. Another thing I kind of noted in this is, you know, Joker's big plan of giving out $20 million in cash so he can kill everybody. I feel like that plan would probably work in today's world.
Yeah, we were like, there's no way these people would be this calm with all this money flying. It would be people murdering each other to get to the money.
I think that plan would still hold up today.
He wouldn't even need the gas. We'd kill each other on our own.
That's one of the things that's great about this movie, right? I mean, that's a Joker plot that we haven't seen since then, and it was really clever, you know? And I liked that a lot then, and I still like it now. It's also a very visually interesting scene. So
and he's
him dancing and throwing the money and stuff, and he's just loving it, and he's trying to convince the crowd that he's the good guy and Batman is the bad guy. That's so great.
And he's so mad when Batman steals his balloons. I just love that.
It really upsets him. That's a very classic Joker thing. He gets upset about this weird, like, you never know what he's going to get upset about.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, Nicholson really captured the essence of what Joker was up until this point.
So you can we end this officially, Derek, and say that Nicholson is your favorite Joker?
I don't know that I can. I think I would need to watch both this and The Dark Knight back to back to really.
What about you, Rachel?
To be fair,
are you gonna be cool or are you gonna be Derek?
I'm gonna be Derek.
Oh my gosh! You both disappoint me.
What's new?
I'm sorry.
That's true.
He did a wonderful job, and I think a lot of that goes back to what we mentioned earlier, which was that Keaton and Burton weren't really comic book fans. They didn't really know these comics, but Nicholson did. Not only did Nicholson know the comics, but the Joker was his favorite character. And so he wanted this, he knew what it was, and he knew how to make it his own. And I think that's why, at the end of the day, he's kind of the biggest takeaway from the film. And why he's still considered by many people to be the definitive Joker.
Is it bad that when that woman took off her mask at the dinner table, I was like, oh, that's not bad.
No, because they kind of play it up to be like, she's been completely massacred and then she's just got like a little scar right here.
Yeah,
it's certainly not pretty, but it's certainly not as bad as it could have been.
It's like it reminds me of what was the VR movie we watched and reviewed? Remember the movie from the book?
What?
Ready Player One.
Yeah, Ready Player One.
Oh.
The chick's like talking about how ugly she is and you'll never want to meet me, and then she just has like a red spot on her face that's like fairly visible. Yeah.
In my head, when I was reading the audiobook, I thought her face was going to look much more complex.
Right. Because mm-hmm. that's what, yeah. But then in the movie, she just has like this tiny thing. But yeah, this reminds me of that. They play it up to be this huge thing. And then, yeah, she just has some scar on her eye.
All right. Well, I think we can agree that this movie still holds up pretty damn well, that there's still a lot of aspects that have been carried through to the rest of the live action Batman films, at least to date. And if you haven't seen this movie in a long time, I think it's worth a rewatch.
Yeah.
Agreed.
All right. Well, then that's going to be it for us this week on Screen Heroes. We hope that you enjoyed the show. I did promise. Oh, wow. We were way over time, but I did promise last week that we would go over reviews that we've received recently, because we've received several reviews. And I want to thank everybody who has sent in reviews of our show on various podcasting platforms. I'm stalling a little bit so I can pull these up, but we've received some on Apple. We've received some on Podcast Addict as well. If you have reviewed us anywhere else, like for example, Stitcher, where we are now available for the first time, you can find us on Stitcher. You can also review us there. Definitely let us know if you do, just in case we miss it.
You can review on Stitcher?
You can. Okay. Yes. Yes, you can. So we received a few reviews recently. I'm going to go through Apple first. Just kind of going through these in...
Is this 1 stars and 5 stars, or are you only reading 5 stars?
I'm going to go through all of them here.
Oh my God. We're going to be here all night.
We're not going to be here all night. Here's what I'll do. We'll break them apart, because one of these is from September and that one's brand new. So we'll just break them up here a little bit. So we did get a 1-star review, and this was somebody who apparently reviewed us once before. I don't think they did a written review before, but I apologize if they did. I don't recall. But they changed the review from a 5-star to a 1-star, mainly because we're apparently too woke and we made fun of Chris Pratt. So that's all I'm gonna say about that.
Or was it specifically call out one person?
I'm sorry, the female host made fun of Chris Pratt,
which we always refer to Rachel as the female, because that's her only definitive quality. So,
well, we're Ferengi here on Screen Heroes.
I don't get that joke.
Yeah, well, look it up. Don't have to. It's fine. So yeah, so I'm sorry we're too woke for you is really all I have to say there, but we did then receive two more. That was in August. We received 2 more reviews on Apple in August, both 5 stars. So thank you very much to both of you. We appreciate that you enjoy the show. Kyle S316 says, love it. Fantastic people, fantastic conversations, all around great content. So thank you, Kyle. And AJ Beamer 8605 said, great podcast. It's a wide range of thoughts and options on various pop culture and comic book stuff. The hosts always seem to really know what they're talking about and care a lot about the content. If you love comic books, movies, etc., I highly suggest giving it a listen and subscribing. So thank you, AJ, for that review. We really appreciate it.
We only had to pay for one of those, too.
I don't have any money to pay for reviews.
Yeah, you barely pay me.
We did get our first review on Podcast Addict ever, though. So thank you to Jilly Bean for the 5-star review that you left us on Podcast Addict. I truly appreciate that. We'll come back to more of these. Like I said, we had a few more, so I don't want to take up too much time here. So we will...
get them out of the way. Just get them out.
Okay, fine.
We'll finish it up. Then we don't have it lingering.
All right. Let's burn through them then. We've got another 5-star review on Apple Podcasts that came in just a couple of days ago here in September from Ray's 18. And it's
not related to Ray.
No, that's not me.
R-A-Z-E 18. Solid podcast. Feels like hanging out with buddies, just shooting the breeze like we used to do pre-COVID. Great friendly hosts who clearly have been fans of this stuff their whole lives. Thank you, Ray's 18. I appreciate that. We do try and keep it conversational and chill.
And woke,
that's right.
So woke.
We do have our first review on Stitcher, though, from 3 days ago. 5 stars from Anonymous. So thank you, whoever you are. I appreciate that. Great podcast for film and superhero nerds. Hosts are fun to listen to and have great chemistry, especially the female. So I think this is somebody who maybe we know and knows this joke. 5-5 will continue to listen. So thank you. We are available on Stitcher. So please subscribe on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. We're pretty much anywhere that you can find your podcasts. You can find us at Screen Heroes Pod on Twitter or heroespodcast.com. Please join our Facebook group, our Screen Heroes Facebook group. You can join us live Tuesday nights for this show. Thank you to everybody who chatted with us live during the show. We truly appreciate you interacting. Ray.
So, before we go, I started something new for next week. Right as the podcast started, I added a poll in our group. You guys get to pick our topic for next week. And currently, it's going to run for a full day. But right now, Hellboy 2004 is winning. So
which
we'll talk-
I voted for because I'm pretty sure my girlfriend's never seen it and I want to force her to watch it. So nice. This is the perfect reason.
Nice. Okay.
Awesome. Sounds good. So yeah, join the group and you can vote and help us pick our next topic. You can find Ray at Siren Ray on Twitter and Facebook. You can find Ryan at Buster Props, and you can find me at The Star Trek Dude. We are Screen Heroes on the Heroes Podcast Network. Thank you for joining us. We will catch you next week.